Take a network break, sacrifice a virtual donut to the gods of hotel Wi-Fi, and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. I'm Drew Conrimari. Greg Farrow is dialing in from the heart of Silicon Valley, and we're joined by guest commentator John Free. Today's show is sponsored by us, the Packet Pushers. We've launched Ignition. That's a brand new membership site. It's at ignition.packetpushers.net, and it has free and paid membership options, and we'll tell you more about that later.
You're coming in from Silicon Valley, Jerry. It's really hot here today. There's an awful lot of nerds out there on Highway 101, so keep your eyes peeled for them.
It's in the Packet Pushers news helicopter over 101. How's it going out there?
I am shabby. Network field day, the usual sort of, you know, intensive many, many hours of briefings in a very short period of time.
You're being beaten about the head and brain with tech presentations.
Exactly. It's been fun, though, as always. Like, it's like being thrown over the side into just like new ideas and new stuff. And of course, the vendors bring their best stuff. Well, in theory, anyway. it's not too bad. Like, it's always entertaining. It's like worthwhile.
Good. Yeah. And one of the stories we're going to cover is related to that. So we'll get to that. Before we start, we just want to mention that a personal recommendations really help. So if you like Network Break or other Packet Pushers podcasts, tell somebody, tell a friend, tell a colleague, or write a review on iTunes. It really helps us. We appreciate it. All right, let's get to the news. Last week, the tech website The Information reported that Amazon was considering selling white box switches to the enterprise, and that story went off like a bomb in the networking industry and caused Cisco, Juniper, and Arista stock prices to dip. Now it's been confirmed that AWS is not, quote, actively building a commercial network switch, so it was much ado about nothing.
Oh, it was pretty good, too. Like, it took like about $8 to $10 billion off Cisco's market capitalization. It wasn't like a little bit of a bomb. It was like a good-sized one. This is that Amazon effect. They call this the Amazon effect at the moment, where Amazon decides to move into any market that's, as long as it's reasonably rational or, like, you know, makes sense. And they just assume that because Amazon is so big and generally just so successful at these things, that when anything like this happens, they just, it's a done deal and all their competitors are dead. So
right. And we saw the same thing happen when Amazon mentioned that it might get into healthcare or drugs, then drug maker price, stock prices dipped as well. Yeah. So the Amazon effect is real.
And they're effectively buying companies on, when they do these things, their share price goes up basically by the value of the acquisition they're planning to make, and their competitors drop by the same amount. So it's just a distortion of the capitalist system that's pretty amazing. But there is actually some sense to it. I created a YouTube video to work down all the different ideas. It actually could make sense in the sense that Amazon obviously has already making its own switches in some categories. There is a lot of switches it's not making. So in theory, if it wanted to just, while the items are sitting in the warehouse, it could put the SKU onto the Amazon website and let people buy those switches. The question is, of course, if they were to do that, would they be supported? Would they be unsupported? Would they go and, you know, work with companies like Cumulus or IP Infusion or Peek8 or, you know, those Arcus to go and provide supported operating systems for those switches? You know, it could happen. We see that Dell's making a very fine business out of selling switches to other people without operating systems, well, with and without. They could also get into the home market, I thought. They could maybe make a switch that's really targeted at retail, something like the 8 to 24 port category, low price, very simple, basically so you can plug in all your IoT devices, because I don't know about you, but I've actually got a 12-port switch at home that's just for that.
Well, John, we were just talking before the show, you've got a whole bunch of home networking projects going on.
Yeah. You know, most of my IoT stuff is all wireless, and I think I'm somewhere in the 50 device range in my home network right now. You know, and Amazon jumping in on this, somebody's got to do the math on how much money are we making selling some of these products already versus what could we make if we were to build it ourselves? Because I think just about everybody in the home market that's buying tech equipment and networking equipment is probably going through Amazon at one point or another. So they've already got a big chunk of that market. The question is, can you make more money on it? And, you know, Greg, you hit the nail on the head on the support piece of it, which is where, as I look at how they could do it in the commercial market, Amazon could be a killer in this market, but I don't see them being able to support anything that's outside their environment, their OS, and their configuration.
Well, I like the idea of being able to buy a switch, and if it doesn't work, just return it, without having to haggle with a tech support organization or beat a sales rep over the head with a purchase order just to get my switches returned because they're faulty. Mm-hmm. You know, like today, it takes an enormous amount of effort to return faulty product to vendors because their return processes are pretty atrocious. There's a certain sex appeal to it. You know, and there's other reasons as to why Amazon would want to do it, right? Obviously, as they increase volumes, their own switching infrastructure for AWS gets cheaper. There's an effect there. Recruitment, Amazon's running out of people to recruit. Increasingly, they're finding a struggle to get people to go and work for AWS. There's a lot of people who have worked for AWS and have left because it's a bit of a tough place to work. It's a pressure cooker where they want you to work. Most people I'm talking to are working sort of 60-plus hours a week at maximum rate. That sort of working model does burn out potential employees. There's only a certain number of people who'll do that for a certain period of time. So being able to recruit more, so if you know you had Amazon switches out there and there was more NOSes, I'll bet that was a factor if you're thinking about these sorts of things. And also think you could be seeing a little bit of like public cloud posturing. We've seen the public clouds make all sorts of outrageous statements about, you know, we're all in with AWS and, you know, you don't need any other cloud but public cloud. You know, they don't even recognize on-premise cloud. If you watch an AWS presentation, they'll never refer to a private cloud ever. As far as they're concerned, there is no cloud but public cloud. And that sort of marketing mush is kind of happening. So it's easy to believe that there's some antagonism there, a marketing message to be done. Pretty interesting. You know, there's lots of reasons why it wouldn't work too. Like, it's not a product that enterprise markets want to buy. They'd probably all have an apoplectic fit. Cisco's very much out there selling SDN controllers to lay over the top. So in a lot of ways, the actual impact of selling switches is mitigated because it's really about the SDN controllers these days, not the switches themselves. That's a fine balance. We're seeing vendors move away. Anyway, so after all the kerfuffle, Amazon denies it will challenge Cisco with switch sales. Do you believe them?
Well, you got to look at the timeline. So I haven't done the math on when the rumor came out and when they said we're not going to do it. But in the midst of everything this week, you had Prime Day hit where they couldn't keep their site online. So if you're going to go out and be running networking and tell everybody you're going to build and sell network switches and you can't keep your own system up, you know, that would be a good reason for me to kind of pull back and say, yeah, maybe we ought to rethink this for a few months.
I don't know. I think, you know, I've been working with vendor product, branded products for plenty of years, and they don't work either. So I'm not too worried about that. I don't think anybody really gets it. Let's face it, you know, you buy vendor branded products, you put them in the data center rack or out in your campus, and you pretty much plan to have 3 months to try and work out where the bugs are and whether you can work around them. So I don't think that's a big deal. The enterprise IT is pretty much immune to faulty products. They're used to getting them is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I would say the closer you can get to, the more that enterprise networking becomes more like a disposable model, the more Amazon becomes attractive, to your point about the fulfillment and the replacement services.
Mm. My take was that part of the rationale on that the information offered was that by building these switches, Amazon would sort of include a faster route into their own public cloud and was supposed to build out their public, you know, get enterprise customers to buy more Amazon public cloud, put more applications in there. But there's other ways to do that besides a switch. So I always thought, when that news came out, I was like, why would they do this with a switch? You could do some kind of router or even some kind of HCI-like appliance, build a pod in your enterprise data center that's sort of essentially going to be a kind of hybrid between your data center and the Amazon cloud. So them walking back from this isn't a surprise. Maybe they were testing the waters a little bit. Maybe there was some misunderstanding about where Amazon is actually headed. It's not a switch. It's some other kind of mechanism for bringing enterprise closer to Amazon, some kind of direct connect connection. So I don't think this is the last we've seen of it, but I do believe that Amazon is not going to start going against Cisco with a white box at this point.
Yeah, there's an SD-WAN play in there somewhere.
Right.
Or remote for branch offices. If you can get a branch office and connect all of those services that you were using from AWS directly from the branch instead of sending it through the headquarters, there's a play there if they can figure out how to make that work.
Yeah, avoiding Direct Connect. So Amazon's Direct Connect, which is using private MPLS connections, is very popular with enterprises, partly because connecting via the internet pipe, you know, via internet connections is very hard for most enterprises. You'd think that, you know, enterprises would have the skills to do such simple things, but apparently not. And maybe building an SD-WAN type appliance that could simplify an IPsec tunnel to a VPC would be the thing.
And that sort of ties into our next story, which is about AWS Snowball. The cloud provider has upgraded its Snowball Edge hardware device. Snowballs are essentially a box of disks designed to store data in locations where you have little or no network connectivity. And when the drives are full, you literally ship the box back to AWS, who puts all the data into their cloud storage. In a blog about the news, Chris Wall calls it essentially sneakernet on steroids. So the news is that AWS is now adding EC2 compute instances to Snowball so that you can do some local data processing and analysis before you ship that box back to AWS. So maybe a hint of where Amazon is going. Obviously, they're targeting the edge here, but this could also be a hint of sort of what they're thinking about on how to get more information, more data, and more applications from the premises into the cloud.
I think that this is quite in the sense that, remember that enterprise IT is usually quite structured and quite disciplined, and the idea of just dropping a bunch of disks on the floor, you still need a bunch of compute to suck data off to put it onto the box. So adding a couple of some sort of compute to the box itself to start sucking the data up out of your private data center, your on-prem, makes a weird kind of sense. I would say this is a reaction to enterprises who can't do it themselves because they're idiots. You know, putting some computers in there and starting the scripts up that start doing the data copy there. And also, importantly, it also gets you doing the metadata stuff. So if you've got a server there and you're copying data, it's actually going to be integrated into the AWS cloud. So you can use that to tag the data as it comes in and have it part of the AWS orchestration system when it's on site.
And I look at it, I totally strip out all the technical and I look at it just from a business standpoint. And what Amazon is really good at, and if you've ever gotten an Amazon delivery on a Sunday from an unbranded white truck that comes and drops something on your doorstep, or you look at Amazon Air and they've got 32 767 cargo jets, they're figuring out the logistics. They're figuring out the last mile. They did that whole thing with drones a while ago and doing drone delivery. Amazon's in tune with what's happening in customers and the supply chains, and they're actually trying to figure out, if I can solve these last mile problems, if I can solve the supply chain problem and all the logistics, which is what I happen to be really good at, I can become very sticky with these customers.
Yeah, those servers on the Snowball are going to be managed by AWS's orchestration system. And like you say, you just drop the box there, and now all of a sudden there's computers and disks. There's no excuse for not, oh, we have to find a server to run the extraction.
Yeah. And again, I like the way, John, you put it, that they're solving that last mile problem, which can be a tricky bit.
I wonder if there's also an angle where there are people who specialize in moving stuff to AWS services, like big companies. I can imagine somebody like not a SAP and an Oracle, because they're building their own clouds, but those types of middleware systems. And they actually want to provide a service to migrate to a product hosted in the cloud. And a Snowball arrives on site, and all you have to do is connect it to the network sort of thing.
Yeah, look at guys like Accenture. They could turn this into a whole practice.
Yeah, and they don't have to have hardware. And when the Snowball arrives, it's all orchestrated.
It's all pre-configured, yeah.
Yeah, so it's actually probably driven by that. AWS is particularly driven by what customers want, where they see the opportunity and backed up by some analytics. Mm-hmm. So there'll be some madness in here.
Yeah, you'll find some areas like in oil and gas or mining where you've got some very remote locations that are getting huge, huge amounts of seismic data or other telemetry data that they've got to track. And, you know, why wouldn't you drop one of these out on an oil rig and go pick it up in 6 months and bring it back?
Right. Yep, that's the idea. All right, moving on. Our next story is also slightly related to Amazon. Big Switch Networks, they make SDN software for enterprise data centers. They've announced new capabilities to enable AWS-like VPCs or virtual private clouds on your premises inside your data center. And Greg, you were there at Network Field Day. They did a presentation yesterday or the day before. You got some insight on this.
Yeah, I got kind of excited about this. What they're saying is, most of the time when we talk about doing multi-cloud, vendors are talking about, how do we take the way that the on-prem cloud works, the way that your legacy data center works, and how do I map that onto a public cloud? So they want to talk about VLANs and subnets and routing and VPNs and, you know, all that sort of stuff. What Big Switch is saying here, which is quite a transition, I think, is, why don't you just take the model of networking that the clouds are using and put it on top of your on-prem data center? Pretty straightforward.
It's pretty straightforward.
I mean, a part of AWS's success in the early days was that they actually got networking right. So you had this thing called a VPC. Whenever you instantiated a server, it connected to the network in your VPC. Boom. Everything just happened. And what Big Switch is saying is, they're sort of pre-announcing. The product's not here today. It's about 6 months away, they claim. But they were able to give us a functioning demo. So what they actually showed us a demo of was, you've got, you know, say 5 on-prem clouds around the world, and you've got 10 on-prem systems in various data centers around the world, being at Google, Azure, and AWS. And then you click a button and you just see all these little lights. And then you can say, I want to create a host, and it just attaches to a VPC. Now, whether it's in AWS or whether it's on-prem or whether it's, you know, across the world, all those hosts appear in the same virtual network. It was just a mind-boggling experience. And when you take it a step further, they said, let's consider how this works in the private cloud. So in the private cloud, They're saying you can put a Big Switch fabric infrastructure. So that's a white box with the Big Switch operating system, the Big Switch NOS, and their controller on top. And you could have Nutanix, a Docker cluster, an OpenShift, and some VMware and some vSAN. And as soon as you plug it into their fabric, they'll recognize, they'll see a new host coming onto the network. They'll go off and query the Nutanix controller, the vSAN controller, the VMware, the Docker, and then they'll recognize what that host is, and then they'll drop it into the VPC that exists. And that's it.
Yeah, my take was, because we also did a DataNaut show with them about this, is that essentially what they're saying is, we'll give your internal developers an environment that they're very familiar with, using constructs that they're familiar with from the public cloud, you know, mask it to look like it's Amazon or Azure or Google. And on the back end, we give you all the tools and the work that you need to actually make this infrastructure still function, because it's not magic what Amazon is doing. There's still a lot of network engineering that has to go on behind a VPC that the consumer doesn't see. So Big Switch is still giving the networking side, the engineering side, all the tools and controls and visibility they need, but having a higher level construct that's very familiar to developers who are used to the cloud and want to do it like they do in the cloud.
Yeah, that was the idea, is that you don't want to know what's actually happening in the mechanics under the networking. This is what you, how you give your on-prem cloud to a developer. You just say, well, you know, if you want to instantiate a new server, just go right ahead. It almost lets you build a bare metal cloud. It's like the dream. You just walk up and plug some servers in, and then you let it auto boot. If it auto boots as a vSAN node, the network goes okay. You know, maybe you want the same server and you want to use it as a Docker node. Reboot it. Let it image itself as a Docker server. As soon as it appears in the Docker cluster engine, Big Switch will know, and away you go, right? It really does move on-prem cloud conceptually. And again, it's not here. It's still got some time to go, but we did see a working demo. It really does change the way I look at on-premises clouds, because up until now, it's always been, you know, oh, we're going to do EVPN, and then you're going to be able to route, your, you know, we're going to do L2 over L3. I don't care about VLANs. I don't care about subnets. What I want from a security and an operational perspective is, this is my group of Docker hosts, put them in their own zone. Or this is my group of vSAN, put them in their own zone and give them this cost strategy. Boom, walk away. Don't care about the rest.
That's right.
Yeah, and this is almost kind of a classic glasses half full versus half empty when you look at, am I going to start from my enterprise and move towards the cloud, or am I going to start with the cloud and move towards the enterprise? And quite frankly, the cloud guys have it all figured out, because they don't have a lot of legacy problems that all of the enterprise stuff does. So this is a smart move on Big Switch's part. It was IDC, just this past week was touting that 80% of the customers are talking about cloud repatriation, and they believe that over the next 2 years, about 50% of the apps might be coming back inside. So a lot of people might have moved to the cloud to, you know, quote unquote, yeah, clean things up. And now that we've got them clean, well, hey, we could run that here just as cheaply. So it's
just so generous. They didn't move to the cloud to clean things up. They moved to the cloud because it's the latest fashion.
Fashion clean, you know, tomato, yeah, tomato.
I've got to have the latest red Ferrari. Let's just go, baby.
So I think there's a lot of, you know, definitely enterprises, not everything was ever going to go to the cloud, and clearly there's some opportunity for some things to come back. I think everybody's just trying to find their equilibrium at this point. And I like how Big Switch is approaching this, because, you know, cloud first was really kind of a more of a marketing term for a few years, but this is a good indication of how cloud first should really be working.
Yeah.
Yeah. My take is that what Big Switch is thinking about is, we're giving you tools to make your developers happy, but also keep the network engineering staff happy. And so they're winning two core constituencies here with this direction and the strategy.
There was a bunch of other things they were talking about too, because keep in mind, with Big Switch, they do also do a monitoring fabric and a visibility tool. But now you can actually build a network fabric that spans on-prem, off-prem. It's also L2 ready. So because of the way Big Switch builds their things, so if you want to integrate your legacy network into there, I generally have the view that if you've got a layer 2 legacy network in your data center, just leave it alone. Just stick it in the corner and pretend it doesn't exist, and just migrate everything away over time to a new network. That would be my general recommendation. But they've also got these extra tools where you can start to do visibility. So you can have packet capture tooling and flow tooling in the public cloud feeding into a big analytics tool so that you can actually see where the data is going, what's happening, and building visibility. So all of a sudden, you do actually have an end-to-end networking strategy that you would normally only see from the bigger vendors. I find it quite interesting to see what a company that's just focusing on software and doesn't have to worry about hardware, how they can transition much more rapidly compared to our, you know, bigger incumbent vendors.
Mm-hmm. And Greg, you saw these tools in action. And one of the things that I saw from a lot of the Twitter chat this week was that the UI was beautiful and the consoles seemed really nice. Everybody was really raving about the look of this. Like, hey, yes, somebody really spent some time to figure this stuff out. So what was your take on that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I've been banging on about for 5 years is just how butt ugly most vendors make their software. I did talk about Cisco's SD Access when we saw them in last year. I think I saw a demo from SD Access. Maybe it was January. Just how much visual appeal it had. Like, not overly complex. It wasn't like it was colored and it had pretty pictures and all that sort of stuff.
It was clean.
It was clean. There was nice fonts and, you know, and so Big Switch has obviously done the same thing. And the graphs and the charting had obviously been done with an aesthetic sense. And yes, visually attractive to see. And I think that's important, because as we move into the era of analytics, if you want to sell analytics, it has to be visually attractive to sell. It can't look like a dog's breakfast, because customers are used to seeing something beautiful on other websites. When you go to, you know, excluding Facebook and AWS, those things are butt ugly. But, you know, generally people want something that's visually appealing.
Well, especially if you're trying to then sell the results of the analytics back to the marketing guys.
Mm.
Right. Make it pretty. All right, we'll have plenty of links. So if you want to explore more about this announcement, we'll have links in the show notes. We got to move on. A British government report has identified potential new threats with equipment from the telco giant Huawei and downgraded its level of security assurance. This is according to a story in Reuters. The report was made by the Huawei Cybersecurity Evaluation Center. This is a lab specifically set up in Britain to examine Huawei hardware and software for national security risks. And this report that's downgrading their security level was co-signed by GCHQ, which is Britain's intelligence agency.
Interesting part about this Cyber Security Evaluation Center, good Lord government. I mean, you couldn't have come up with a better acronym. is actually funded by Huawei. It's part
That's right.
of the deal that Huawei cut with the British government. It's actually funded by Huawei.
They set up the lab, yeah.
It's now come out and basically said that the company that funds it is a security risk. So, cue irony, I guess.
Well, it's interesting, which is Huawei trying, I shouldn't say spin, but Huawei saying, look, this is what this center we set up to do, so it's doing its work, and so we've got some engineering issues we need to go back and look at. It seems like Huawei is taking it seriously, but there's also not many specifics in the news story that came out. All we know is that the report cited, quote, shortcomings in Huawei's engineering process and some concerns about components from third parties. So we don't really know what's going on, just that they sort of took a step back saying, this center's been up for like 8 years, since 2010 it was set up. And each time they put out a report, they said, yes, we have assurance that there are no national security risks. Now they've gone to limited assurance. So sort of a small step, but
yeah.
Yeah, we've seen both the US Secret Services and the Australian Secret Services actually explicitly state that Huawei is a compromised supplier and should not be used in cases of national security.
Right.
So you can't help but wonder if the government, like this, the Secret Services, have actually intervened here and said, and walked up to these people, tapped them on the shoulder and said, here you go. Start looking here. Do you know what I mean? All of a sudden, the body's been kicked into life instead of doing nothing and getting lots of money and everybody having lots of lovely meetings and congratulating themselves for not doing very much. They've actually had to look at something fairly specific. I would almost bet that that's what's happened, because the report was co-signed by GCHQ, which is an imprimatur to say that we agree with these conclusions, but you can't help but wonder if GCHQ hasn't provided, you know, don't do your own research. Look here, here, see, right there. That's a problem. Now, yes, tell everybody that's a problem. Yeah,
and it's really hard to differentiate between vulnerabilities that are intentional versus unintentional, because getting to the intent of why is this here is always the difficult part. But I'm sure there's people within intelligence agencies in a variety of different countries that are more than happy to provide some insight into this. So I see this as a really big deal, because with 5G on the horizon and Huawei being one of the big players really, I shouldn't say struggling, fighting to get 5G in this next big land grab,
yep,
you know, you've got to have equipment to be able to take advantage of that. And if you're being excluded from areas like the UK, that has a real impact.
And also if it happens in the UK, it'll move through Europe. as well, because those European suppliers, which is great news for Ericsson and Nokia, of course,
right?
Because they are actually the companies who are poised to take over the 5G market. And Ericsson has actually had post. We've sort of been bagging on Ericsson for the last 2 or 3 years on the show as they stumble their way to what looked like oblivion over time, a bit of a Nokia sort of an event. And all of a sudden they've turned it around. But Ericsson's turned it around by doubling down on R&D investments. That's not a popular idea in technology today, you know, but they've literally invested in basic R&D research and now they're reaping some rewards from that.
Right, because 5G is a make or break for them. There's not going to be another transition for them to be able to go capture market for quite some time after that. So it's really a do or die at this point.
Yeah, I agree. And it's just interesting to see technology companies invest in themselves, where we've seen most companies like Cisco and Juniper and, you know, Brocade before them had actually stopped investing in their own technology, stopped investing in themselves and just relying on, you know, acquiring in the acquisitions and then struggling to integrate them and to leverage them. And I just wonder if we're seeing the end of the startup by the startup model and more focus on internal developments.
Are there that many great startups that a vendor like this could be buying that could actually make a bottom line difference for them? And I think all the good ones have been bought up.
Well, I think also it's getting harder to make startups, like to build a product and get market fit that actually then fits into the vendors. Like, for example, the thing about the Viptela acquisition that Cisco made was the company was almost purpose built to slot into Cisco's strategy. But other SD-WAN providers don't fit so well with other companies. So then I see them less likely to be acquired in a, you know, in a big buyout. Now, if you're an investor in VCs, you need that. You want that big exit because you need to roll that money back into your fund and do another startup. At the end of 5 or 10 years, you actually want to close the funds down. So it's very interesting to see this sort of dynamic come around. So lots of interesting stuff.
All right, moving on. The German telco giant Deutsche Telekom, they're joining the Linux Foundation Networking Project as a platinum member. Linux Foundation Networking is a subset of the overall Linux Foundation. Linux Foundation Networking houses the myriad networking projects in the foundation stable, projects like ONAP and so on.
So we talked a lot about telcos getting behind open source projects as a way to de-risk and to de-cost, like to remove costs from their infrastructures. And we know that AT&T has been heavily involved in pushing this and a number of other smaller telcos. Deutsche Telekom is a massive telco, probably bigger than AT&T if you take into account all the, you know, sub-companies that it's got. If it also can get behind open source and openness as a general thing and promote this, and that's exactly what it's doing here. And I think the second thing that struck me about this was that by participating in these open foundations, these companies are actually getting control of product direction and strategy in the same way that they had control of product direction and strategy with vendors. So if you're a big networking IT vendor, you know, or telco vendor, you spend lots of time in meetings with these customers and they tell you what they think the network should be and what direction you should go. And the one of the criticisms of open source that telcos had was they didn't feel like they could get control of the products or the people would do whatever they wanted to do and therefore they couldn't trust it. And now they're actually joining the steering body of open source projects to get that ownership, that sort of complete ownership of the product direction. So I think that's an interesting trend that, you know, the Linux Foundation is now talking to what is effectively the customers and the customers are now getting control. Will we see these people actually commit like Intel levels of money into these open source projects? Will AT&T allocate, you know, a quarter, $250 million to put developers into these projects that they're using? Haven't seen that yet. So until I see big money, and when I say big, I mean hundreds of millions of dollars, I want to see hundreds of developers from these companies contributing to open source projects, then I'll know it's real.
Well, we have, I don't know if we've seen that amount of money, but certainly with AT&T, we've seen them take their DNOS, the network operating system they had talked about, and they rolled that right into the Linux Foundation. Now it's called DANOS. So they are actually committing code and presumably some level of developer support to the project. Again, to get that kind of influence and control over the direction of how it evolves. As for the money, I don't know, but certainly they're throwing code and probably a few bodies at it.
Yeah, and Deutsche Telekom, they didn't just join the Linux Foundation. They joined as a platinum member. So that puts them in the highest tier. And really, if you look at the people that are the platinum members, everybody is a producer of technology with two exceptions, AT&T and Tencent, who I would put as consumers of the technology. So Deutsche Telekom is basically putting themselves in the same camp as AT&T and Tencent to say, look, we got to own what's going on here because we're going to be consumers of this. So I think that's a pretty big commitment, and this is a pretty big deal.
Mm. Until the money flows, I'm a little curious. I'm a little, right? You can tell me that you love me all you like, but until you put a ring on it.
You should write a song like that.
I don't know if it's a ring, but it's a platinum engagement at least.
Yeah, there's a difference between participation and commitment.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you got to start with the proposal. So I think this is the proposal, and we'll see what happens with the ring down the road.
That's exactly right. I'm hopeful. Yeah, hopeful of a consummation, shall we say. Well, let's take this opportunity to talk a little bit about our sponsor today, which is ourselves.
Hey.
Packet Pushers has launched a new membership site called Ignition. Drew, what are your thoughts on that?
You can find Ignition at packetpushers.net. It's got a free and paid membership tier. What we're doing with Ignition is we're trying to create content for professional development, for ways for you to advance your career through like some online training courses, through understanding the market, understanding technology. So that's the point behind Ignition.
Yeah, and what we're doing there is today we are still creating that content. It's a little bit difficult to run the podcast and the blogs. So what we're really asking you to do today is to join up, and if you've got the available cash, and you've ever wanted to support us, to give us something for what we've given you over the years, then this is your chance to give us that financial support. And what we're then doing is using that money to grow the content in the library. So I will publish an ebook. I finished the ebook and handed it over, and Ethan is now loading it into the system. And it's my condensed collection of career advice from the last 5 years of the podcast. I often talk to people about careers. It's one of the most common questions, you know, how to get a job. And I've just finished a 20,000-page ebook, which collects all that together. It's in four parts, and it's an unusual read, I've been told. But somebody actually told me the other day they wish they'd read it 2 years ago because they would have been in a better place. I thought that was nice of them. It didn't cost me much to get them to say that.
Just a beer or two.
But we have lots of big plans to sort of back it up. I have a series in development called Hot Buttons, which is a way of saying Greg Rants. What I'm going to do is take those rants that a lot of people don't understand or get upset about, and I'm going to explain them, and I'm going to put courses up there explaining my viewpoint and backing it up with data points that led me to that view. I've got three of them on the fly, and the first one I think I'll get finished is Why BGP Sucks. So there you go.
Oh, boy. Don't start small.
That's low-hanging fruit.
easy to win, that one, I think.
And there is content there. It's not an empty site. We do have videos. There's some white papers up there. There's exclusive blogs. We're also have got every back issue of Human Infrastructure, the Human Infrastructure newsletter. That's up to like 85 issues up there now, the Link Propagation newsletter. So there's content already. If you're interested, there's a free tier. We can just sign up. You get Link Propagation, Human Infrastructure, and a few freebies. The membership tier is $99 a year, and that gives you access to everything that's on the site right now. So head on over to ignition.packetpushers.net. Check it out. All right, back to the news. SD-WAN vendor Cato Networks, they've added a new feature that lets customers base networking policies on user identity in addition to things like application type. So Cato's SD-WAN controller will sync in with Active Directory or LDAP, get a user's role, team, or department information, and then use that to influence policy. So for example, if you want to ensure that voice calls from the sales team get the highest priority so that the customer gets a good experience, you could say, okay, anybody who's in a sales role, make sure that their VoIP calls get a higher quality over whatever else is going on that link.
I think this is one of the things I'm seeing with SD-WAN is this idea that a security technology. And I think anybody who's running an overlay network has decided that selling overlays as a value proposition aren't getting traction. And increasingly, they're turning to security and the fact that, you know, it, say, reduces the broadcast bandwidth or reduces escalation sideways, or if I can identify stuff, then I'll start to have a better thing. We've seen a massive run-up in products in the security. Look at Palo Alto. Look at Fortinet, how much growth they've had in the last 5 years. They all think right now we're seeing this trend emerge that SD-WAN is now a security tool, not a WAN tool. And I guess we're going to see a lot of this in the months ahead. I'm not convinced. I'm not sure that this is the right idea, but it's a possibility.
Yeah, and I see this. You know, anytime you do anything around user-based roles, you're only as good as the data behind it. And I look back, I spent 10 years at Dell in about a dozen different roles because they kept moving me around to solve different problems in the business. And so I had all kinds of legacy stuff in my profile, I'm sure, that would track me back to other departments. And so I think it really matters. What are you doing to actually actively manage and maintain that user data? And if you're aggressively using that, then this is a brilliant idea. But if you're looking a lot of this like, yeah, we'll get around to updating that later, you're going to have problems.
You could indeed. Yeah, you could indeed. That's a good point. Something to be thoughtful of. My take is that this is, it's sort of part of that one-upsmanship of SD-WAN vendors trying to find ways to outdo each other, say, well, you know, we can identify 3,000 applications and allow you to enact policy. Now we can do applications plus identity and so on and so forth. And it's also that movement of SD-WAN away from just a plain networking solution to let's try to align networking with the business more closely, more fine-grained. That's what I think is going on here.
That's a good point. You're talking about a maturing of this industry. Instead of it doing just simple path management, it's actually maturing into features.
It's maturing into features, and it's mature. It's trying to say, I'm talking about real business value here. This is what we're getting out of the technology. It's not just faster. It's trying to shape business outcomes. That's the idea.
Yeah. I mean, branch security has always been a problem. We've always just pretended it's not a problem because we don't have a solution.
And as the business is mature, you stop selling to IT and you start selling to the business. And so you got to start solving some business problems if you want to do that.
But John, you do raise a good point. Go make sure your Active Directory is clean. That's always, ask about the data behind it. Yes, good point.
I don't care. That's not my problem.
All right, moving on. I don't know what plans you might have for this week, but Cisco has released 25 security advisories and the requisite software patches, so that may give you something to do. Some fixes include things for unauthenticated remote access to Cisco Policy Suite. There's also patches to the Viptela SD-WAN routers and software. Other affected products include WebEx and the Nexus 9000.
What is it? Is this like patch week this week? The Oracle critical patch advisory this week was over 334 patches. Can you believe
25 is nothing.
Yeah. Typical of Oracle to say we patch the most stuff ever. Like as if that's
turn that weakness into a strength.
Exactly. It's kind of bizarre. And so for Cisco to come out with 23 is quite amazing. I one of the things I'm heartened by is that to some extent, at least, these companies are actually working on security risks that normally they would have ignored. In the past, we've seen companies, Cisco in particular is one I'm aware of, they'll just say, yes, this is a security risk, but it's not one that we're going to fix. And I think increasingly, customers are piling the pressure on these companies to get these security vulnerabilities fixed. Now, whether that's by direct representation or through, you know, support saying in public security is a top issue for us, I do think that this security number of security advisories we're seeing patched is a reflection of the fact that, like I just said, companies are taking security more seriously, willing to allocate more resources to it, and that's feeding into the vendors. And we're seeing Cisco, Oracle, and all the others start to be much more conscientious about getting stuff fixed.
Well, if you turn on the news every night, and you know, God help you if you're in the U.S. and you do that, all you hear about is, you know, hacking and, you know, people trying to manipulate elections, and this stuff is out there. And so I think you can't put your head in the sand and say, we're not going to address these, because you don't want to be the company that gets called to the carpet when the next election gets hacked.
Yeah, there was an article just in passing. There was an article about a Russian bank. They had an obsolete router. They had a router in there, and somebody hacked the router and then privaxed their way through into the network and stole $1 million. From the router. So
yeah,
this stuff is actually happening. The old days of where the router was kind of like nobody paid attention to it, hackers are now looking for unpatched or devices that haven't been updated, like printers and fax machines and routers, and taking them over and using them to pivot in and get a privilege escalation and be a real threat.
Absolutely. It's definitely better to know that these vulnerabilities are there and the patches are available than to pretend like nothing's wrong. So kudos to Cisco and everybody else who are taking security seriously and working to fix these vulnerabilities. All right, moving on. Microsoft, they released their fiscal year 2018 financial results. They brought in $110 billion in revenue for the year, including $30 billion alone in the fourth quarter. And that's a rise of 17% year over year.
Who would have thought it? Like 2 or 3 years ago, you would have thought that Microsoft would be sailing into the long good night.
They have done a remarkable job of staying relevant and putting out products customers want. It's pretty fun. Yeah, I'm kind of stunned.
Yeah, Nadella deserves a victory lap on this. I think he's done a really good job of navigating the company from a box software company of years ago into more of this cloud subscription model. I mean, if you look at where the company is doing well, you know, even in the hardware space, which you wouldn't have expected Microsoft to do well at, they're actually holding their own against the iPad. So I think the company overall is made a very smooth transition over to this new business model, and I got to give them thumbs up on this.
Yeah, if there's not a bronze bust of Satya Nadella somewhere in the Microsoft campus, there probably should be.
I'm not so sure about that. I don't think these things come down to one man. I think it's a whole team thing. And ultimately, I still believe that a CEO makes a half a dozen decisions in a year that actually matter, and the rest of it is pretty irrelevant, pretty much like anybody actually in any job. The challenge here is that when Nadella came in, he also replaced most of the senior execs inside of Microsoft as well, ran a broom through and cleaned them all out, and then got them to focus. What he made them just understand is that the old business is dead and we have to find a new one. Most organizations, look at what we're seeing from, you know, Cisco's continuing to do pretty much the same things it's always done. It hasn't changed a whole lot. IBM's still doing pretty much the same things it's always done. They didn't commit to cloud like Microsoft has. Microsoft didn't just, we're going to do cloud. They spent tens of billions of dollars in cloud. And the absolute commitment that Microsoft brought to that is the one thing that stands out. And that is not just because a CEO made one decision. That's a whole team of decisions right the way down the line and a stripping of the old order and willing to throw away revenue, to be honest, to make that happen.
But I do think a CEO actually, in that sense of running the company, that's where the CEO really matters, because they're the ones who makes that kind of decision to say this level of management has to go.
No, they don't. There's a board. There's a group of senior executives. There's a whole bunch of mid-level of executives.
That's true, but they're the ones who take the heat when the decision doesn't go right. They're the ones who face dissension when you're trying to re-steer an entire company culture. So I don't necessarily subscribe to this sort of great man theory of executives, but I think you do have to give him props for some leadership.
I mean, the cloud thing was obvious. It's not like he invented cloud.
No, I didn't say he invented cloud. It's about turning a company's culture.
He hasn't invented a new business model. He hasn't cured cancer.
No, not at all. But but turning a corporate culture away from what we do is sell a server operating system and some applications to what they are now, that takes some effort.
Not really. It just takes money.
And rich.
We're going to build a cloud. Here's $10 billion. Now make sure you get that done. Now tell me what you've done by next week. And then what he said was, well, we're all in with cloud. Here's another $10 billion. Yes, I know I'm going to cut your budgets or across the rest of the company. I don't care about your old products. We're in the cloud, right? And he got it right. Plenty of other companies that went into the cloud that didn't make it. Cisco, IBM, VMware. The list is endless.
Okay, so you're that's fine. You're welcome to your opinion. I'm welcome to mine.
Yeah, you absolutely are. I'm not taking your opinion away. You can have it. I'm not.
we'll let some MBA students figure this one out. They can decide. All right, well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
You can find me blogging on packetpushers.net. On the Twitters, it's at etherealmind. I had a really funny tweet this week I just wanted to share with you. I said, somebody told me you can't put lipstick on a pig. So here I am putting Ruby Luscious Red on the console port of my router.
And if you like that, you can get a lot more on Twitter. John, I know you're social. How about you? Where can folks find you?
You can find me at John Free on Twitter, or you can find me at johnfree.com on the web.
And how do you spell free? Because it's not free like, not F-R-E-E.
It's specially free. It's F-R-U-E-H-E.
Great. All right. We'll have a link in the show notes too if you want to find him. I'm Drew Conroy-Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, as we mentioned, please give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or tell somebody else about it, and maybe they'll like it too. And check out our membership program. That's at ignition.packetpushers.net. Lots of good stuff there. And as always, thanks for listening.